in the summer, the you know, when the trap competitions are going on, the time for it is just about as the sun is going down. So it's the most remarkable setting. It's really just wonderful. And then there is something absolutely balletic about the way these teams move. You have the five people, and you know, they'll call for the bird, and the bird comes out, and they take their shot, and there's this very formal counterpoint going on all the time. And meanwhile, it's, you know, sunset in the most spectacular little corner of the world, because it is, you know, Concord's a beautiful town in almost any place where you are in it, but there's some certain places in Concord that stand out. You know, you go up by where Verrill Farm is and look over the ridge there, that's one of them, and walk around Estabrook Woods, that's certainly one of them, and I'd say the Rod and Gun Club is one of those places too. It's just amazing. It's just a wonderful sight. So the sight absolutely plays a role in the feel for the activities that are going on there. But and those activities are, you know, they are of the collegial nature that Henry's talking about, and absolutely the, you know, that acclimatization of putting your hand to whatever job needs doing, and so you meet people who are there and talk to people and find out what's going on there and find out, you know, maybe there are a whole bunch of things on offer here I hadn't anticipated at all. Pretty cool, you know. So you get to see the whole shape of the club, because the club's got its own personal history, slightly unlike other clubs of this kind in the area, as Henry was saying, even slightly unlike the neighboring club right here in Concord. So they all have their, you know, they're these organic institutions that develop according to, you know, by their own rules and generate themselves through the membership. Very interesting to see. And I was at the sports writers dinner this year, and I should think they were impressed with that place, because it's really the real thing. It really is this big log cabin. I don't know. So it's that site. It's the site that has a lot, or, you know, conveys a lot of this impression of the place, but not the, you know, that's completely different from the membership, you know, and the membership's got its own life, too, that's kind of acted out in that place now. But there was a club before there was the club house, as Jim was saying, and in fact goes back even somewhat beyond the 40s. Charlie D wrote up that history in the 70s, I think, wrote up a little history of the club, and he was able to trace it back to about 1923, when one of the, was it a McCone who was a trap shooter?
Augie McCone.
Augie McCone was a trap shooter, and was so good, he was world champion for 1 or 2 years. And it's almost as if he was so good that he needed a club to get along. And so I get the impression from Charlie's account and from whatever I can hear is that that's kind of where, that's the roots of it. It started out with an extraordinary talent in Augie McCone. So that's still there.
And the name of this history again is...
I'm sorry, Jim, you were saying
that? No, I was thinking about Harry Tuttle. I think he was the first Tuttle. President.
Oh, yeah?
He was the fire chief in town.
Oh.
And he was, I think he was the first president of the club. I'd have to go look at the plaque if it's still up in the cribbage room, but I know he was one of the first presidents of the club way before they had the clubhouse.
Yeah.
Probably at the way before the time I got involved down on Main Street. But,
well, we have a picture of a dinner in the old armory, which is the 51 Walden Street, which was now it was called the Veterans Building.
Right.
Dinner of the membership there before the club had a site where they could have a dinner, and it's kind of interesting that all of the men there are wearing hats and suits in that picture with.
Yeah.
You would not see somebody wearing a suit at the club today. But I took a picture of something which shows the, I think, the how times are changing. In the bar area, there is a round table, which is an institution. It's called the Round Table, and the people, there are usually old timers sit there. They come there for coffee in the morning, and they have a certain, place in the club. And probably about a year ago, and usually has things like, hunting and shooting magazines on it, shotgun news, and shooting times, and Cabela's catalogs and things like that. But the table was bare, and there was a copy of the Wall Street Journal on the table. And I took a picture of it because I said that was something that shows how the membership of the club has changed over the years.
And then the name of this history of the club was?
I think it's here in the library.
The name you gave was Charlie D.
Oh, Charlie D. Was the author
of it. Was the author.
Yeah.
But the title of the work, not sure.
I don't know.
I just wanted whoever heard this probably tape to be able to reference it.
Did he do it for the newsletter? Or there's a copy of it here in the library.
You mentioned Augie McCone.
How do you spell his name, by the way?
Last name is M-A-C-O-N-E, and Augie would be A-U-G-G-I-E, I think. He lived up on Strawberry Hill Road, as a matter of fact.
His family owned a lot of property that was next to the club.
Still do.
Yeah. You were, Henry, you were mentioning that you used to use Fairyland Pond as a sort of lending library for frogs.
For wildlife, yes.
I used to use McCone's Pond for that with my son.
They still do ice fishing up the club? Speaking of the pond.
Yes, I think the answer is yes. I think, although I'm not sure how, whether it's been, it's kind of depends on the weather and the, I know in recent memory we've done ice fishing out there.
Years and years ago, my dad built a box to contain all his ice fishing paraphernalia, the chisel and the traps and so forth. And once he finished the box, he had to show it off. So we went up the club a couple of times to go ice fishing so that he could show the other members the box that he built and how it slid open and everything was right at hand and so forth. And we also went to Warner's Pond, come to think of it. We used to ice fish over there. But you mentioned Charlie D, and I recall a hunting trip that we were going on down the ocean, and it was Marty and I and my dad and Charlie, and they pulled a stunt on us that I never will forget. They stopped over on Thoreau Street. We're all in the car, all ready to go, probably on a Friday night. 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock, something like that, and they stopped at Sullivan's Package Store. And they went in, they come out, and my dad, I guess, had a brown paper bag with what turned out obviously to be a bottle in it. And the two of them slide in the front seat, and Marty and I in the back seat, and off we head. Now, those days, we didn't even have 128. So to go down to Plymouth, you went down the old Route 3, over hill and dale and around the corner. It took forever. And I remember it was a river, North River. Ooh. And we used to cross the North River. And that was like, we're finally getting there type of thing. But anyway, on this particular evening, we start out. And pretty soon, the two of them start passing this bottle around in the brown bag. So Marty and I are looking at each other. Now, this is totally out of character and so forth. And as time went by, they were telling stories, but the stories became a little bit slurred and so forth, and we're getting a little bit nervous in the back, and every once in a while my dad would kind of drift over the yellow line and so forth, and to the extent where Marty and I finally started to say something to them, and, don't worry about it, it went fine, and so on and so forth. It was a nightmarish ride all the way down. And when we finally got there, we got out of the car, and he said, "Here, why don't you have a sip?" And I said, "Oh, no, that's okay." He insisted on it, only to find out that it was milk. So they had been pulling our string all the way down for an hour and a half. The two of us in the back seat were absolutely petrified. We were going to have a head-on collision or go off the edge of the road. And they were having a great chuckle at our expense all the way down. It was an interesting trip.
Questions over in this corner?
Well, I'd like to hear more about the change, the excitements for the future of the club, the disappointments over the shifts, and how it reflects the changes in the town.
Well, I think the change is reflective of the world we live in. There's nothing dangerous about it. As they say, there's nothing constant but change. And same thing for any organization, this club or any other club. And I think with the advent of electronic gaming and all the other things, all the other sports, everything that's on TV, the activities and so forth might change, but the social fabric of any club, this club included, is to get together, enjoy a company, and talk about different things and participate in different things of a common nature. So that's, in my time, it was hunting and fishing. And at the end of my time, it became archery. As I was fading out of active participation in the club because of my family and work constraints, the archery movement was building in the club, and they were probably predominant at that point in time. Whether it's balanced off now again or not, I don't know, but the club will survive. They are, I presume, financially stable because they paid off the mortgage years and years ago, which is why the July 4th and Labor Day outings went from two a year down to one July 4th. And then once the mortgage was finally paid off, again, that 20% was getting tired of doing it year after year, and they didn't need the money to meet the obligation anymore. So it just kind of went away. One of the big money makers at that time was the auctions they used to run. The club membership would donate what we would probably call today yard sale stuff. And instead of having yard sales, which were unheard of, they donated it to the club. The club displayed it in the meeting room for a month or so before the July 4th shindig. And then at the auction, my dad, who was a licensed auctioneer, would auction off these donations to the bidding public. And that, at that time, boosted the attendance at the July 4th field day, which had waned some because of the changes in demographics that Henry talked about. All of a sudden, this auction was attractive to folks to come up and find some great little things they could use and so forth, and was a moneymaker. But they finally, the July 4th went away because, again, there was no pressing need for the money, and everybody had lots of things that they could do at home, I'm sure.
So, and you said the town had
started their own activity, right. They call a picnic in the park, which is the Emerson Playground, where they have run a family activity with music and fireworks. Bicycle parades and fire engines and all of the different organizations and towns have booths where they will either distribute their literature or sell like the Rotary sells slush and so on, and it's the people who are around have been more attracted to that, and it's made it I think, very difficult for the club to maintain that July 4th activity, and even though we may have tried. But also a lot of people are just go away, you know, especially July 4th weekend is a big, you know, and now I think our membership is probably composed more of people who, in fact, you know, have second homes or can afford to go away and rather than spend their July 4th here in town. It's one of the things that makes this town very attractive during the summer is that most of those people have gone away.
does the club do a booth at the?
No, we don't. But that's a good idea. We probably ought to talk about it.
Now you've done it.
Do they still get a lot of rental income from the rental?
We do. We rent out our hall to all kinds of activities and organizations, everything from birthday parties to meetings. We probably have a rental at the club maybe a couple of times a month. Oh, I know what I wanted to say is with the archery people, that group, that has been a very steady group, and they are one of the most active groups. They are really, although they refer to them as the archery group, are really the people who are the most serious hunters. And they actually have their own meeting every Thursday night at the club where they cook and they socialize and just, spend time together there. And if you want to come on any particular night, when you're going to find a lot of people in the club, at the club Thursday night is a night to go there.
It used to be always Wednesdays, but now it's
Thursday. Well, maybe they just...
But they still have Santa Claus and stuff?
Yes, we have a children's Christmas party. Mm-hmm. We do. We have and I think we have an Easter egg hunt. All those kinds of things that kind of have gone by the board in most places. I think that you mentioned a lot of what's changed has changed with the times. But I think the nice thing is that we've changed more slowly. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like having one foot out the car door and dragging it on the ground, or as a teacher. As a teacher said of my oldest son, that he marched to a different drummer, but one step behind.
I think I got shanghaied by my father one year, but I got shanghaied by my father in the Chamber of Commerce to play Santa Claus for the chamber. And as a result, I had a Santa Claus suit that they rented and so forth. And therefore, I was a great candidate to be the Santa Claus at the gun club.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember I did it for a number of years, and I had a great deal of enjoyment both in the town and at the club, particularly at the club, because the parents would bring the kids up to sit on Santa's lap. And at that age... Then I suppose 7, 8, 9, 10, where the belief was starting to fade. It used to be a chuckle to see the parents and then have the young boy or girl tell me that they were Bobby Jones or something from, and I said, oh yeah. And I remember, I think it was in Farrell, lived down on Shady Lane off of Lexington Road, and they brought up, I think, his son. And it was obvious that he was studying my phony beard and trying to see if Santa Claus was real and so forth. And I asked him who he was, although I knew he was an Inferrara. I didn't know his first name.
What?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, his last name?
Inferrara.
Spelled?
Inferrara. So I said, oh, yeah. And have you been a good boy and all this kind of thing? And he was giving me the kind of a snide answer. I'm thinking, yeah, he's not a believer anymore. And I said, now, let's see, you live down on Shady Lane. And you could just see his eyes pop open. And I said, the log cabin house. I said, you know, you've got to clean that. Have your father clean the chimney. Because last year, and, you know, this kid went away completely confused because he now couldn't decide if Santa Claus was real or make-believe. And I had so much fun that the next I did the chamber thing for many years. We used to set up a big chair in what was the Middlesex Savings Bank under the portico there, go up to the depot, do the same thing, go to West Concord, and then we'd go to the hospital. We used to use the fire truck to get around. But I had so much fun with the kids at the gun club that when I noticed somebody downtown that I knew, in those days you knew a lot of people in town. Today, of course, you wouldn't. You'd throw a few things out which would catch them all off guard and confuse them, and, you know, maybe this is real and so forth. But at the gun club one year, I think the funniest thing was when my wife brought my oldest son. And I couldn't imagine that. I said, of all the silly things for her to do, because if he ever found out, he'd give the whole thing away in front of everybody else. So I had to be very careful and managed to get through the whole thing without my son realizing that he was talking to his dad, which was kind of funny.
Wow, you really are Santa Claus.
Yeah, maybe you really are.
But that was always a good take for the kids. The club always had all kinds of family-orientated events and so forth, and that was just one that I happened to, as I say, be pressed into service, volunteered by my dad. He was very good at volunteering lots of folks to do lots of things. And,
thank you.
One kind of last question in my mind is about the 40 acres today. Is it possible to actually hunt any creature at all on that 40 acres with a bow?
It's more closer to 50 acres. And, yes, people do hunt on our property. The members do.
Gun hunt?
No, I'm not. I don't think so. Les, they do shoot migratory birds on the pond, shotguns. I mean, that is not something that carries very far. But they do some bird hunting on the pond.
That was the extent of it back in my time. There was
because there's some duck blinds out there and stuff like that. But I would say I'm not aware of anybody actually hunting on our property with guns. But they do certainly go out there with bows and shoot deer on our property. In fact, we have I think that the archers have planted a couple of dozen young apple trees in the parking lot down at the end, and looks like they plowed up an area where they're planting some kind of, alfalfa or whatever it is, some kind of grain that would attract deer and other, other game. So I think that, I know that people do hunt on our property with bow.
And what about bird hunting, pheasant hunting, or that's more shotgun?
It is a shotgun thing, but we do have wild turkey. There are wild turkeys on our property, and I don't know whether people hunt them, but I think they probably do. Pheasant, there is no natural pheasant that we do. And I think most of the places around here where they hunt pheasant are stocked.
Coyotes sort of took care of the pheasant about 15 years ago.
And the grouse along with it?
I don't see any.
Never seen one.
Yeah, I don't recall back in my time up there that other than an occasional person on the pond for duck season, that anybody ever hunted the land itself is not conducive to hunting because it's all heavily wooded. And there was no inherent population of fowl or anything else to hunt. So that...
I would just mention, Henry mentioned before that membership is still perking along, that the membership is... Jim mentioned it was about 300, maybe in the 50s, and it's
and it was,
it's getting close to 400 now.
So that's 375 right now, and about about 75 of that 375 are actually life members, which is a status that people have attained after a certain long number of years as a regular member. So we've got a lot of old timers and a lot of.
But it's not, and you mentioned too that a lot of fraternal and social organizations are graying, and it's, you know, it's a very well recognized phenomenon, and you'll see it in lots of different aspects. I mean, it happens in, you know, antiques and collecting too. You know, all the collectors seem to be graying, and it's not an activity necessarily that young people are picking up on, but. It's just, you know, the gun club isn't graying. I was thinking it's actually sort of greening in a sense that the members that are coming in are, you know, they're 30s, they're 20s sometimes. And, you know, what wouldn't the Rotary just love a new 30-year-old member? You know, it just doesn't happen.
Is the membership still closed?
No.
Because back in the 40s and 50s, as a marketing ploy, they made it a closed membership. I think they had 100 members at the time, but they closed it at 250.
Well, that was what Musketaquid has a 100 member limit, their club. As long as I have been in the club, we have not had a, when you say closed, mean a ceiling on the number of memberships.
That's why I gave up my membership, because when I became too heavily involved with the family and the Concord Minutemen and some other things, my dad being very active and having a life membership, there was a waiting list to get into the club at that time of probably 75 people.
How long ago was that?
Probably in the 60s.
Yeah.
So I gave up my membership because I knew I would have access from my dad, so somebody else could join that would actually enjoy it and participate.
No, we do not. We have, it's an open membership now, and I think the view is that the members are an asset rather than, and they, you know, they pay dues,
right,
which is an asset, and they bring interests and skills, and we're not even close to the point where any of our facilities are overtaxed, so that if anything, many of them are underutilized. So there's the only reason to limit membership would be the reason that you mentioned, which is the kind of the marketing issue. Whereas, and people still do ask me, is can I join? Is the membership open? Assuming that it isn't, but in fact,
it was.
And I think it does, to some extent, make it more attractive to people if they think that.
Well, when they first started, it was closed at 100 or something like that. And when they finally hit 100, they let it sit there for a year or two, and then they made it 125, and then they made it 150, and at one point, I think it was 350.
So it's something that we debate from time to time, but, you know, that
if, so it would be more attractive if what?
If people think that it's, Jim mentioned the marketing thing, and there is a certain, there's a certain kind of appeal of an organization where you think you have to wait for a year before they have a spot for you, and it does build up some anticipation. It also would prevent people from dropping out because they haven't used the club, so that they think, well, I can always join again if I want to. So they're more likely, I think, to drop out if there is no waiting list to come back. So it's a marketing issue, but the reality of the situation is that at least for the foreseeable future, there is no disadvantage, and there are many advantages to having more rather than fewer members. So,
I was just wondering, how are there ways that the older members pass along their knowledge or the traditions?
By being there. Yeah. By being there. I mean, they people associate with each other. They meet at sitting around the club. They meet at different activities. They meet at dinners. A lot of the, I mean, if you go out on the trap range, you'll find people who are in their 60s and 70s shooting alongside 16-year-olds.
So the transfer of the legacy is informal and,
yes,
and happens and just as a matter of...
It's built in.
Yeah. It's yes, built it's in. Informal, which is the way life should be.
But nights they have, for instance, the cribbage tournaments or anything of that nature. If there were members who found it difficult to get out and about, it was quite common for other members to arrange to pick them up and drive them to the club and drive them home so that they could still participate and be part of the club. I know that most of the senior members, the membership in the club and the social gathering is a highlight for them each week. And there's always somebody picking up somebody and driving them up the club for a dinner or whatever.
I wonder if that's still the case now.
Sure. Well, we do have people who drive for some of the older members, who especially some of the older members who have difficulty driving at night because of their eyesight, get taken to activities by other members.
There's a, Henry touched on something too, an aspect, I guess, of the club, which is that conservation aspect, the conservation camps and so on. And that recalled certainly something that Henry Thoreau wrote about in Walden, which is that, you know, if you want to know what's going on out in the woods, ask the hunters, because they really know it on this first person, firsthand way. And so as Henry also pointed out, the connection, Ducks Unlimited is this group that preserves open space. Well, they preserve open space because they like to shoot ducks. But what's the upshot? They preserve open space. There is this deep connection between the interests of the people at the Rod and Gun Club and what anybody would term conservation interests and so on. And yet, probably if you were to ask the members, are you a green kind of hippie? And they would say no.
they would be offended by that. But the point is that
they all contribute heavily to Ducks Unlimited. And I think Ducks Unlimited is probably the number one habitat provider in the
continent. But they have that knowledge and that relationship and that understanding of, you know, that outdoors. And it's that kind of thing that, when you're standing out there, as I say, well, the sun is going down on the trap range, that's the kind of thing that the 70-year-old gets to impart to the 16-year-old.
I just think the intensity of your experience is much, almost in any activity, is increased by the fact that you are out there to be doing something.
Yeah.
And it is a much more intense experience than just going out there and looking at it, if you know what I mean. If you have some role, some mission, some goal, you know, to get you out there, you're motivated in a way that you are not if you just go to admire. I mean, it's the same thing with music, for instance. I mean, you know, it's one thing to listen to it. It's another thing to play it. And you could listen to things over and over again and still not be sure which one it is or what the name or what the recognizing it as by title or composer. But if you've played it, you have no difficulty in knowing exactly what it is. And so if you're out there in the woods trying to look for tracks and trails, mm-hmm. and then you really do participate in the environment, which is
well, it's also a great way to bond with the younger generation. I mean, my dad took me out all the years that we used to go, quote, deer hunting in the western part of the state, and it was the getting up at the before the crack of dawn and driving for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then getting out into the woods before daylight and having that father-son type of thing, and so much so that when my boys were of age, I did the same thing. But the funny part of it is, although we used to call it deer hunting, I can't remember in all the years we ever went that anybody ever fired a shot. Mm-hmm. It was more of a walk in the woods.
Yeah, but if you said, son, let's go for a walk in the woods, you say, what, Dad, you crazy?
I did learn the difference between the various tracks and things. Beaver ponds we stumbled across out in the woods and so forth. And I recall with my son Ryan when we were out one time out in Warwick, Massachusetts. We're out in the woods and had gone all the way out. And we stopped. And proverbial, you could hear a pin drop. And I think that was a revelation to him to be out there in the middle of the woods and not hear a thing except the whistling of the wind through the trees and no airplanes, no traffic, nobody talking, and so forth.
And still there are things to hear.
Oh, yeah.
When there is silence.
I took my wife, quote, deer hunting when we first got married because she was all against it and so forth. And we found some tracks, so we followed the tracks for hours. Never saw a thing. And I always wondered what the heck would I do if I ever did see something, because I, first of all, didn't want to really shoot it. Second of all, I couldn't envision lugging it all the way back to where we started. But anyway, we had spent the 3 or 4 hours tracking. Finally, she had enough. And she said, let's head back. And I said, yeah, okay. So she started off. I said, where are you going? She said, back to the car. I said, not that way, you're not. She said, what do you mean? I said, that's not the way to go. Oh, yeah. I said, take out the compass and have a look. So she took out the compass and looked at it. And she said, well, I don't care what that, you know, that's the way back. I said, well, you can go that way. But I think I'm going to go this way. She was insisting that the car, that was the way to go. So, of course, we went about 50 yards the way the compass said to go and came out to the tote road, which took us down to where our car was. And I said to her, I said, that's one of the first lessons I taught the boys. It's whatever that compass says, you better believe it, because if you don't, we'll be looking for you tomorrow morning at the crack of dawn, because you'll never find your way home. Got to follow the compass.
Well, this has been great. Fantastic. It's. I never knew there'd be so much to say about a rod and gun club.
Oh, we haven't even begun.
It's true. It's
there's so much. I mean, there's so many more stories, and Marty has a ton of stories that you haven't mentioned.
I think we're going to see him. Hoping.
Are you? Well, good.
I don't know. It's on the list.
Good. Well.
Well, whatever he says, don't believe it.
No, that has nothing to do with the value of stories.
We'll take it with a grain of cribbage.
Any other final comments? No, it looks like there's. So much left to say, I know.
I'd like to see you go out to the club and have a look at it so you see the context, what we're talking about. I mean, whether or not that's part of your project, just as a kind of as a matter of kind of getting an eye, you know, getting an idea of what we're talking about, I'd love to see you just come out.
Also, there's a pictorial history of a lot of the stuff that we've talked about around. I made an attempt a couple of days this past week to try and locate slides. Unfortunately, my dad was big on slides, that he took when the club was being built, when the pond was being dredged and built and so forth, and didn't have any luck because of 30 or 40 years of accumulation up in the attic that's in the way. Wasn't where I thought it was. So I know it's there someplace, or it's at another place, but there are probably some pictorial record that should go with this that's available.
And this man, Charlie D., that was mentioned, had made home movies of all kinds of things in the town, including the club, which David has seen and I think is going to be shown at the that dinner that you're going to.
Right, the Concord...
Business Partnership.
Business Partnership. This is Charlie Jr. now, who's who's showing those. And it was Charlie's uncle, actually, who started that back in the 30s.
Right.
It's quite an archive, too.
Yeah.
Well,
much to do.
Much to do, yes.
Much to do.
Mm-hmm.